Couple of texts. Let's look. Daniel. We were in Daniel this morning, but let's look at Daniel chapter 11. And I also want to look at Revelation 11. I think that's interesting how those two work together. Daniel 11, the last verse in Daniel 11. Well, actually, that last few verses from 40 to 45, and we're not going to be talking about Daniel this morning. That's not my point. We're going to be talking about Hebrews. But as an introduction to Hebrews and the way God works, verse 40 gives us an indication of what verse 45 is about. It begins at the time of the end. When was the time of the end? When was the beginning of the time of the end? 1798. When was the end of time? Well, we're in it now, but that's an accident, I think. 1844, the end of time. So the time of the end, 1798, the end of time began in 1844. Verse 45, there's a punctuation mark at the end of that verse. What is that?
Period.
Yeah, it's a little dot, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then verse 1 of chapter 12, we see the second coming, right? At the time of the end, shall Michael stand up, and the great prince which standeth for the children? Okay. Remember that punctuation mark in Revelation chapter 11. The time of the end is being discussed here in chapter 11, Revelation 11. The end of time is also being discussed here in chapter 11. Verse 13, at the same hour was there a great earthquake, and the tenth part of the city fell, and the earthquake were slain, and men 7,000, and the remnant were affrighted, and gave glory to the God of heaven. Time of the end of time language. Verse 14, the second woe is past, and behold, the third woe cometh quickly, and there's a punctuation mark. A little dot. And in verse 15, what do we see? The second coming. I've talked with people in the past, at times, who a question comes up, skeptics bring this question. And you probably have heard it. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? You ever heard that? Yeah, I'm talking about God and supernatural things. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? And you just have to shake your head and say, well, you know, that's a bad question. My question is, how long can we stand on a dot the size of the head of a pin? We've been standing on that dot for a long time, since 1844. How long can we stand on a dot the size of the head of a pin? I believe Paul answers our questions in the book of Hebrews, chapter 4. So let's turn to Hebrews, chapter 4. We'll continue our study. We stopped about last time, about verse 5 or so. And we're going to read on verses 6 through, I think, 11 or so today. Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, you're probably going to get there before I do. 1 and 2 Thessalonians, Timothy, Titus, Philemon, and the next page, Hebrews. How many can recite the books of the Bible, by the way? I see a hand. Not anymore. You need to practice that.
Yeah, I know it.
Practice that. How many books are in the Old Testament?
66.
No, not in the Old Testament. That's the total Bible.
Joyce. How many books are in the Old Testament?
39.
And in the New?
27.
For a total of 66. And if you'll remember, what was it? 39 in the Old Testament, 3 times 9 is 27. If you have those little things that you have to remember. 39, 27.
Well, actually, I don't. That was just something I thought was curious how that worked out. That does work. But yeah, we need to know where things are in the Word of God and be able to turn to them. If you say, wait a minute, that's, I have trouble finding Job because it's farther back than I think it should be. But anyway, beside the point. Hebrews. Are we in Hebrews?
Yes.
All right, we're there. Paul is answering these questions about life and about what's going to happen to us. He's answering questions about time of the end issues. He's answering questions about, well, what was that word there? Greater evil. How do we escape the greater evil? Paul was answering those questions in these verses here in chapter 4. And there was a question, will God ever bring us into the promised land? He said he would. Will he? Is his word good? Is it strong? Is it powerful? Well, we read his word is strong and powerful as a two-edged sword, able to cut. Is his word really like that? And there were questions. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? From the skeptics. Yes, God will bring you in, Paul's reply was. He will give you rest. This has been God's purpose from time immemorial, from before the world began. It has been God's plan to bring us into His rest. After His work was finished, He rested. You remember that in Genesis, is it chapter 2? He rested. That rest was as definitely a part of his program as was the work. His rest was. Yield yourselves to the fashioning hand of God and find rest, was God's counsel. He will give you rest. Rest for your soul. Rest from your wanderings. Rest both spiritual and physical. Rest. He will give. Now here, Paul in Hebrews chapter 4 applies this to his own generation. The Jews had been God's chosen people, but despite this, it seemed to them that their wanderings and their weariness and their suffering had continued just right on. No rest. True, they were in the land. True, they were where they thought they should be, but they had not had rest from their enemies. Never had there been rest. In verses 4 and 5, we read, for he spake in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise, and God did rest the seventh day from all his works. And in this place again, if they shall enter my rest, the rest from sin and sinning is that in which God is vitally interested. That rest is closely connected with the Sabbath. Rest in God means oneness with God, a complete dedication of the whole being to God, with every obstacle to perfect communion with God being removed. I was listening to a radio program the other day. It was on Sunday afternoon, and it was a church broadcast, and there were a lot of good things said. They said we should stop sinning, and I said, amen. They said we should stop intentional sinning. And I thought, oh, now we're going to have a problem. Which is true, and they did quote from Hebrews 10, where we read, what is it, if we sin willfully after we have received a knowledge of the truth, you remember how that goes. Hebrews 10, 26 to 31, there's a little passage there. We should stop intentional sin. And whoever the pastor was that was on the radio said, you know, I've stopped that. I've stopped intentional sinning. And I thought, wow, that's quite an admission. And I wondered about people in general. Do you know any bad people in the world? Are there bad people in the world?
Oh, yeah.
There are. Now, those people that you have in mind, and I'm not going to mention any names, but those people you have in mind, do they consider themselves to be bad people? No, they're good people. They're on a mission. They have something
better for society, better for whatever, for themselves, for their friends. I think, you know, even Hitler, you know, we think, oh, Hitler is a bad guy. But he was doing a righteous work in his mind. He was doing a good thing. Even though we say, no, that wasn't a good thing, what he had in mind. Not a good thing at all. He was a good person. And we justify our actions because we don't want to have to deal with ourselves, I think. You know, if we looked at ourselves and said, you're a bad person, we really wouldn't have much reason to live, would we? Now, there are some people that are just downright mean, and they like being mean. But would they consider themselves to be a bad person? I don't know. I know people who go and do stuff, terrible stuff, and then they go to confession. Father, forgive me, I've sinned. And their sins are absolved. And they go about their merry way. I'm a good person, even though I have sinned. We need to stop intentional sin. Yeah, and if you know of intentional sin, that needs to be stopped. If you know to do good and don't do it, that needs to be corrected. No doubt about that. But we justify our sin. We say, well, it's not really as bad as, you know, we might think. And Joyce, again, I think you said last week, it's wrong to say I've made mistakes. People expect me to make mistakes. Therefore, I'm going to continue to make mistakes because it's what is expected of me. And I know I can't do anything different. So just keep doing what you're doing. You ever thought like that? I can't help myself. And that's really what I heard on the radio was, well, you know, there's stuff you're going to do and you can't help it. Stop intentional sin, but the things that, you know, it's not so bad. It's okay to sin. Well, it's not really sin. It's just mistakes. And I think about Daniel. You know, we just read about Daniel there in chapter 6. And I wonder about Daniel's prayers. And there was a suggestion someplace that Daniel could go to the lion's den because he had seen what had happened to his three friends in the fiery furnace and say, well, God, you kept them safe. You're going to keep me safe. I believe that would have been presumption on the part of Daniel. And I don't think that was Daniel's experience. Daniel said, I believe in God, and like his three friends, no matter what you say, King, if we go in the fire, okay. If we get burnt, okay. If we come out alive, that's okay. But we trust God regardless. Purposed in his heart, yeah. And I think that was Daniel's experience. He had, well, you know, we talk about relationship. That's a funny word. But he had a good relationship with God. You can have bad relationships too. We need to be careful how we deal with ourselves and the honesty that we have in our own hearts. And don't be, you know, have our vision clouded by things that we think, oh, well, that'll be nice. You know, Daniel didn't think like that. He purposed in his heart to do what was right. The rest of the soul that Paul is talking about here means entire sanctification, a yielding of all to Christ, a sinking into God. And then whatever comes out the other end, it doesn't matter. You depend on God for everything. God combines sanctification and the Sabbath, saying that the latter, the Sabbath, is a sign of the first. Well, you might want to keep your finger here in Hebrews, but let's turn back to Isaiah. Isaiah 52. Actually, 56. Isaiah 56. Isaiah. Verse 2. Let's read there. Blessed is the man that doeth this, and the son of man that layeth hold on it. Well, let's read verse 1. Thus saith the Lord, keep ye judgment, do justice, for my salvation is near to come, and my righteousness to be revealed. Blessed is the man that doeth this, and the son of man that layeth hold on it, that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and keepeth his hand from doing any evil. Choose the things that please God. Take hold of my covenant. God says in verses 4 and 5, even unto them will I give mine house, and within my walls a place, and a name better than the sons of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. And the question comes, did this have reference to the Jews only, that, quote, everlasting name? I don't think so. That everlasting name did not get connected to a piece of property in the Middle East. God adds the sons of the stranger, that join themselves to the Lord and serve Him and learn to love the name of the Lord, to be His servants, everyone that keeps the Sabbath from polluting it and takes hold of my covenant. Even them will I bring to my holy mountain. Now that holy mountain, again, that's not a piece of property. That's, well, Isaiah 66 describes it as the new earth. The last verse or so of Isaiah 66. Well, let's look at that. We're here in Isaiah. Flip over there a couple pages. Isaiah 66. Well, 22. As the new heavens and the new earth which I will make shall remain before me, saith the Lord, so shall your seed and your name remain, and it shall come to pass, and this is in the new earth, it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith the Lord. These statements make it clear that the Sabbath is closely connected with true Christianity. True Christianity. With rest in God, with sanctification, so closely that God calls it a sign, the Sabbath, a sign of sanctification. As God rested in Genesis 2, on that first Sabbath with Adam and Eve, perfection met the eye everywhere. Nothing wrong anywhere. You remember there at the last of chapter 1, God looked and saw that everything was very good. And as chapter 2 begins, we find God resting. He saw a finished creation, the whole world united in His praise. The Sabbath was the perfect setting for this occasion. A day of peace. He saw everything that He had made, and He rested on the Sabbath, on the seventh day, from all His work which He had made. And God did something else. Something we read there in Exodus 20. He blessed the Sabbath. And He made it holy. He sanctified the Sabbath because that in it, the seventh day Sabbath, He had rested from all His work that God created and made. God rested on the seventh day from all His works. It says here in Hebrews 4, if you got your finger there, He spake in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise, and God did rest the seventh day from all His works. That's essentially a quote from Genesis chapter 2. And the Sabbath became a sign of sanctification, of holiness, of rest in God. Now here in Hebrews, it is called His rest, my rest, that rest. Some different terms, but God's rest. And it can easily be understood why God should call attention to the seventh day when He speaks of entering into His rest. Because it was His rest. The Sabbath closely connected to rest in God with sanctification. He could do nothing else but make reference to the day. To whom swore He that they should not enter into His rest? Verse 5. They shall enter into my rest. Yeah, to whom swore He that they should not enter into His rest? It was the disobedient that would not enter. To them that believed not. In Hebrews chapter 4, begin reading here in verse 6. Seeing, therefore, it remains that some must enter therein. Some must enter therein. And they to whom it was first preached entered not in because of what? Unbelief. Again, He limited a certain day, saying in David, today after so long a time as it is said, today if you will hear His voice, harden not your hearts. That's a quotation from Psalm 95. For if Jesus had given them rest, then we would not afterward have spoken of another day. There remains, therefore, a rest to the people of God. For he that is entered into His rest, he also hath ceased from his own works, as God did from His. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into the rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. Now here as we read, for if Jesus, who is that? Is that Jesus? It's the Greek form of Joshua, actually. So more correctly read, here in the King James, it's an unfortunate use of that word Jesus. It should be Joshua.
For if Joshua had given them rest, was Joshua able to give the children of Israel rest before they entered the land of Canaan? No, he didn't. It wasn't his, well, if they went in with Joshua and found God's rest, that would have been a good thing. But no, Joshua was not able to bring them into rest. Would he not after it have spoken of another day? So there was another time spoken of that people could come into God's rest, because Joshua was not able to do that. There remains, therefore, well, again, verse 7, he limited a certain day, saying, in David. So even after Joshua had brought them into the promised land, without God's rest, talks about David. Today, after so long a time, as it is said, today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. Time had gone by, hundreds of years had gone by since the time of Joshua. And again, in the time of David, it was today, harden not your heart. And it was as true then, in David's time, and it's just as true today, that there remains a rest to the people of God. The door will not remain open forever. And in Matthew 25, we read the words of Jesus. Remember the story of the 10 virgins. Some went in, some were not able to go in because of unbelief. And the phrase that Jesus uses is, and the door was shut. Today is the accepted day. Don't wait for that door to be shut. Today is the accepted day. Some must enter, Paul says here. God will have his house filled. And in verse 7 it says he limited the day to today. Not yesterday, but today. Today is the accepted time. And if Joshua had been able to give them rest, he would have. But unfortunately, that was not to be the case. Now there are some who tell us that though Moses did not lead the people into the promised land, that Joshua did, and therefore they had their rest. Well, God's purpose was not fulfilled in Joshua. Not fulfilled in Joshua. It was not enough for Israel to enter the land, to be in the physical land of Canaan. God wanted them to enter his rest. If Joshua had given them rest, as was God's intent, his intent would have been fulfilled. But Joshua did not give them rest. And verse 9, there remains a rest to the people of God. This is an interesting phrase. There remains, therefore, a rest to the people of God. Now, in the previous places where you find rest in verse, well, all down through there, verse 3, verse 4, God did rest. God did rest. Verse 5, there's rest. Verse, 7, he limited a certain day, saying, if you'll hear his voice, harden not your hearts, for if Joshua had given them rest. Those words are kataposen, reclining on the couch kind of rest. In verse 9, there remaineth therefore a, not a kataposen, but a sabbatismos. And sabbatismos is more correctly interpreted, well, actually here in verse 9 in the King James is good. I don't know, are you still carrying your NIV? Shame on you if you are. No, I'm good. I was picking on you. Good. What does it say?
Because it has Joshua in that other.
It has, that's right. The NIV has that correct.
It says Sabbath rest.
Sabbath rest, okay. There is a translation, George Lamza did a translation. Actually, it was a double kind of translation, so people are critical of it sometimes. He translated, I think, from, or it had been translated from the Aramaic into Peshittic, and then he translated his English from the Peshittic text. And so people say, well, it was secondhand. It wasn't a good translation. But in his translation, he says, let me see, I've got it written down here someplace. There remains, therefore, a keeping of the Sabbath to the people of God. It's not just there remains a rest, but there remains a keeping of the Sabbath. And as you read about sabbatismos, a little bit about that, that's what it should be. There remains a keeping of the Sabbath. It's not just a day, it's a remembering of the day. Just like what we read, what was it, in Exodus chapter 20? Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work. Thou nor thy sons, thy daughters, thy manservant, thy maidservant, thy cattle, thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Keeping of the Sabbath to the people of God. And this was written, let me see, when was this written? Hebrews chapter 4. It was written about
58 A.D. So some 30, what, nearly 40, no, 30 years, I guess, after the crucifixion, Paul was still saying, keep the Sabbath. There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God, a keeping of the Sabbath. Neither Moses nor Joshua nor David had succeeded in bringing Israel into the rest of God. There remains a keeping of the seventh day Sabbath. The promise is still open. Its fulfillment is not yet exhausted. There is still reserved for the people of God a keeping of the Sabbath. Now the works that we do. Verse 10. He that entered into his rest. Again, that is kataposen. He that has entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own works as God did from his. What kind of works are we going to cease from? Daniel had learned to cease from his works.
Trusting in self,
self-preservation. The days before Daniel got thrown into the lion's den and the day that he was discovered on his balcony praying. Do you think Daniel was praying, Lord, save me from the lion's den? That wasn't in his prayer. Wasn't in his prayer at all. It was, Lord, thank you for loving me, for sending your son to die for me. He said, well, they didn't know about the God. Yeah, they did. The gospel was preached under the chapter 3, Hebrews 3. The gospel was preached unto them as well as unto us. Or unto us as well as unto them. Daniel knew the gospel. And his prayer was not, save me from the lions. He knew about the lions, but that wasn't his prayer. Save us from our own works, our own attempts to save ourselves. You cannot do it. And what was that thing I started out with, what Joyce said last week? You can't do it. You can't save yourself. You've got to depend on God alone, Christ alone in His blood, His righteousness. And that is what the Sabbath is all about, is resting in God and His mercy toward us. How did God rest from His works? Well, we read here in verse 4, God did rest the seventh day from all His works. He that has entered into God's rest, he that is fully converted, will become a seventh-day Sabbath keeper. It will be natural for them to do that. Can that rest be entered on any other day? Now, I've heard it said by some that, yes, the Lord's rest day is on the first day of the week, and it's even sometimes called the Lord's Day. But it's really no more Lord's Day than Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. The Lord's Day is this day, the seventh-day Sabbath. And there remains the keeping of the Sabbath for the people of God. The Sabbath is God's sign of sanctification. We just read that in Exodus 20. But a sign is of little value without the reality for which it stands. And that's sanctification. That's holiness inside. Can you keep the Sabbath without the holiness inside? You can come to church. You can sit in the chair. You can preach. But how about keeping the Sabbath? There's something that happens up here, something in the heart that changes, and that holiness inside is reflected on the outside by coming here and worshiping together. It's more than the keeping of a day. The day was and is important, but it is nevertheless only an outward sign, a sign of sanctification that's already there, a sign of an inward experience, a sign of holiness, a sign of sanctification. Now, the children of Israel, their failure to recognize and observe the Sabbath. Now, were they going to church every Sabbath? Absolutely. But in chapter 3, we see that they could not enter in because of... There was another problem. Could not enter in because of unbelief. So they failed to observe the Sabbath, and it was revealed in an outward state of rebellion, a disinclination to obey God. And that necessitated a purge of the rebels and a trip into Nebuchadnezzar's palace. You read that over in Isaiah 2. The whole mess with Nebuchadnezzar. And you know, that was all based on a failure to keep the Sabbath. Not that they weren't going to church every Sabbath, but a failure to honor God the way it was supposed to on the Sabbath. Now we too, in verse 11, let us labor therefore to enter into that rest. And that's kind of a conundrum, isn't it? Laboring, resting. I'm working hard to rest. Yeah, we do that, don't we?
That's
Okay, what do you got?
Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest.
Okay, I like that.
Be diligent.
Be diligent. Okay, I like that. Let's see what some other translation has to say here. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 4, verse 11. Let us hasten. Actually, that's Douay Rheims. Let us hasten, therefore, to enter into that rest. And the, let's see here. English Revised Version. Let us therefore give diligence to enter into that rest. International Standard Version. Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest. There's something that we have to do to enter God's rest. Pay attention to Him. When He speaks, listen. And when we hear, be compliant with what He says. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. We are to beware lest we follow the footsteps of those who grieved God by their disobedience. Let us labor, therefore. Let us pay attention to. Let us, you know, we have 6 days. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, to prepare for the Sabbath. And that's what they're all for. It's only a recent invention to name them by the names of the week. Now, there are, you know, the other gods and whatever, you know, all the pagan stuff that went on. But it's only recently, probably within the last 100 years or so, that we began calling the days of the week by the names. You pick up old papers, newspapers, you know, it was first day, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day, to what? They were all countdowns toward the Sabbath. It's only a recent invention. You know, Satan, he's diligent. He's working to destroy us. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. God wants us in His kingdom. With every fiber of His being, He wants us in His kingdom. And I've been listening to some stories, and she doesn't like listening to those things. What's it called? Pathways of the Pioneers. Yeah, I downloaded them. I play them in my car. Those are interesting stories about the early Advent from the 1820s, 1810 or so, about people's lives and the history that surrounded that era and the young people that were on fire. Mm-hmm. Not for all the minutiae of the gospel, whatever you want to call it, but they had heard that Jesus was coming. And they said, I want to be ready for that. And they ordered their lives accordingly. Young people in their teens. Joseph Bates, you know, he wasn't an old man. James White, he was, I think, 17 when he started going out preaching. And the privation that they suffered, going out in the winter, I think, we hop in our cars with our heated seats. And it wasn't like that. You know, and they'd ride 30 miles from one town to the next. That's why these towns are about 30 miles apart, you know, because that's a day's ride. You know, so you'd go, you'd stop, and then you'd put up a post. But he'd ride those miles, freezing. And the baptisms that were held, not by him in particular, but others, you know, and the stories go. There was one story, I forget who it was. But anyway, he was down in the water baptizing about 20 people. He thought, okay, we're finished now, and he got out, and some more people came down through the trail there and said, we've heard the story about Jesus coming and we want to be baptized. We want to be ready to see Him come. And so, well, okay, down in the water. 3 times it was ice, you know, they had to break the ice on the water. It was cold. And he stood in that water probably for an hour or so, baptizing these, more than that. In and out. And he'd get through with those, he'd start coming out, and somebody else would come down the trail. I'd like to be baptized. Okay, well, come on. And we read stories about people catching pneumonia and dying. You know, from that, dying for their faith. And I think about Daniel going in the lion's den. He wasn't praying for self-preservation. He was praying that the glory of God could be seen. Not praying for self-preservation. I hear people today sometimes, they say, oh, you know, we need to get ready. We need to get ready. Jesus is coming. I need to store up, you know, 6 months worth of food in my basement. I need to, you know, the Mormons, they have 2 years. If you're going to be a good Mormon, you've got 2 years worth of stuff stored up. I also read that stuff like that's going to be taken by violent hands. And we're going to have to depend on God. Should we have a little pantry that gets us through a day or two or a week or whatever? Yeah, you absolutely should. You need to be able to take care of yourself when there's a crunch. But don't depend on yourself to get through the time of trouble. A time of trouble is what is Daniel 12:1. A time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. If you're depending on yourself for that, you're going to be just like here in Hebrews 3:19, those who cannot enter because of unbelief. Well, I tried, I worked hard. Give up your works and learn to rest in God.